Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about Cuban music. I'm very happy now to welcome to the show Stephen Kotler. He is an author. His newest book is called A Small Furry Prayer, Dog Rescue and the Meaning of Life, and he will be speaking this Saturday, the 30th of October, at 2 o'clock at Garcia Street Books. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So your life in dog rescue started, I guess, when you met the woman who is now your wife. Is that right?
That is right.
And so what happened? What was your first experience of dog rescue?
My first experience of dog rescue was a very good friend of mine introduced me to Joy, and I was immediately smitten, and he knew, he saw it, and kind of pulled me aside afterwards and said, oh, she's an amazing woman, she's a great writer, she's also an author, she's a great, great writer, but she's crazy. And I said, oh, crazy how? He said, well, dog rescue, it's a cult, not a cause. And that was my introduction to dog rescue, was this idea that, you know, I'd been around animal geeks my whole life, and people who were passionate about various things. Animal-related things, but I knew really little about dog rescue, so my first experience was being told that it was a cult, and I got curious, and it actually, you know, I've got 2 decades of journalism behind me, and it made me actually start to dive in and try to figure out what the hell dog rescue actually is, at the same time that I was getting involved with Joy and getting first-hand experience.
What was she doing at the time? You were both living in L.A.
We were both living in L.A. She had been running a no-kill shelter in Mexico for about 6 years, and and that kind of went away, and she had moved back to Los Angeles, kind of a long, torturous move, but she had come back to Los Angeles back about a year, and that was kind of when we met.
To Los Angeles, where they have, as you write, a 90% kill rate in their shelters.
They do. They do. That I don't know how uncommon that kill rate is in most major cities. It's really, actually, I don't know whether or not you know the Humane Society, official numbers by the Humane Society are 6 to 8 million dogs are turned into shelters every year, and about half are euthanized. Those are the official numbers. I have spent years trying to figure out, are they real? How real are they? Every rescuer I've ever spoken to believes they're massively underreporting their data, but I have never found any accurate data above that. But, you know, it's a lot of animals that are getting put into shelters where there's not a lot of space, and the kill rates are high.
Both of you moved together to New Mexico, and you actually bought a small farm in Chimayo with the intention of rescuing dogs.
Yeah, sort of. We mostly threw a dart at the map when we picked Chimayo.
Really?
Yeah. We lost our house in Los Angeles. It was sold out from under us, and we had, at that point, an illegal number of dogs. The legal number of dogs you can have in Los Angeles proper is 3, and we had 8 at that point. And our house got sold out from under us about a month and a half after the peak of the housing market, and rental occupancy rates were like 96%. So trying to find a landlord willing to bend those rules, taken Joy, I think, 2 years to find our house in the first place. So there really was nothing else to do. So we did what, rational people do under those circumstances. We got really drunk, and we made a long list of, like, everything we wanted in a place to live.
What was on that list?
Well, it was silly. Well, first of all, Joy has lupus, and I have Lyme. So we both needed 300 days of sunshine a year because we need to be able to move our bodies. And autoimmune conditions you need heat. We also needed few zoning laws for animals because we had 8 dogs and plans for more. We wanted to scale up our rescue operations. And then it was like everything from a clawfoot bathtub to scientists and artists in the neighborhood. It was really silly. But when we sobered up, we realized that New Mexico was just about the only place we could go. So I jumped in my car and drove out here and, you know, bought a house in 10 seconds, essentially.
And so you ended up being here. And one of the things that I find so interesting about your book, A Small Furry Prayer, is that there's a lot of dog literature online. I mean, if you look up dogs, but a lot of it is about cuteness or about obedience training. And what this story is, it's a human story. It's a human and animal relationship story. It's neuroscience. It's your personal experience. It's dog behavior. It's shamanism. It's basically a lot of the things that I think intelligent dog owners are thinking about and working with all the time, but I've never seen it written down before. Especially all together.
Yeah, the only thing I can tell you is I think part of it is accidental, kind of my experience, and part of it is kind of my science geek, science writer background. The accidental part was when I was, long before I actually met Joy, when I was living in Los Angeles, I had a dog named Ahab, and I realized that just in trying to take care of Ahab, I was faced with all kinds of actual hardcore moral and ethical questions that I had never encountered before in my life. And they were actual real philosophical questions that I realized that everybody who, you know, owns a dog or an animal of any kind has that relationship is going to face. You know, how do you privilege your needs versus their needs? All those kinds of things. And I was pretty startled. I was, you know, 35 years old around the time I got a dog, maybe a little younger. And I was, you know, I turned a corner and suddenly there was a whole raft of ethical questions I had never had to deal with before. And it really got me thinking that there was a heavy kind of philosophical component to, you know, human-animal relations that I hadn't really paid attention to before. That was the first part. The second part was my friend had told me that the animal rescue is a cult. So I started trying to figure out, well, what is it like? What are the actual numbers? How big is this movement? And one of the things I quickly figured out is that animal rescue is a massive movement, right? There are 78 million dogs in America. 20 to 25% of them have been rescued. So 20 million Americans have taken part in a dog rescue. And if you look at the full numbers, there are 15,000 independent shelters like the one Joy and I are running. 150 of them have budgets of $1 million. But the big number and the startling number and what really caught me was, all told, Americans spend $2.5 billion a year on animal sheltering and advocacy. That's a massive amount of money, and nobody knows why. And this is the puzzle I was getting to. Altruism has been a, you know, topic debate going all the way back to the beginning of religion. But starting, you know, roughly in the 1970s, Richard Dawkins kind of settled the debate with the publication of The Selfish Gene, and we've discovered that altruism, it's not really actually altruism, it's really selfishness in disguise, in that we help those who help us pass along our genes. So that's the general idea. Here's the problem. Cross-species altruism, which is helping an animal, helping a dog, doesn't matter what I do for a dog, none of it is going to help me pass along my genes. So we've got this giant mystery at the heart of dog rights. You've got Americans spending $2.5 billion a year, you know, 20 million Americans partaking in animal rescue, and nobody knows why. And as a science geek, you know, here's this giant big question that nobody understands. And on top of it, when you get into the rescue world, you know, I think my wife is an exceptional woman, but I don't think she's any more exceptional than other rescuers. And she's putting 8 to 10 hard, hard hours into the dogs every day. And that's kind of standard behavior for the rescue community. So it's not just like a little bit of altruism. It's she's giving the whole of her life to these animals, and a whole lot of other people are as well, I guess, and myself included these days. And nobody can explain it. So, you know, ethical concerns, this weird scientific puzzle, these were the kinds of things that they brought me into the book, and those were some of the things I first started trying to answer. I was trying to write, nobody had ever written a book that explained the animal rescue movement for people outside of the movement. There have been a couple self-published, I'm an animal rescuer and this is, you know, how you do it, there's some how-to stuff, but there's nothing that kind of like surveys the movement like a reporter would and just says, well, let's take a look at it. Where? How big is it? What's going on? Why is it happening? What's at the core of it? And those were the questions I started out trying to answer in Small Furry Prayer.
We're talking to Stephen Cutler. You make no bones about the fact that you're not only observing it, but you're very much a part of it. And you know, have a wife, and the two of you sleep with any number of chihuahuas and other animals and under your covers or in the crook of your neck, and are dealing with some very tough stuff. I mean, there's a passage which I'm hoping maybe you'd want to read in a little while, which involves a pretty rough situation with the dog. But the thing about it, and I can see why people call it either a cult or a spiritual practice, is no matter how many dogs you rescue, it's a drop in the bucket. You're not going to save all dogs. And yet you keep doing it almost as if it were a practice, just a spiritual practice, a way of giving.
I think there's two answers. There's actually two answers. One is a question that I get asked very frequently, which is what you just said. How can you kind of continue the Sisyphean, you know, push the rock uphill effort without, you know, falling into abject despondency, which a lot of rescuers ask me, and a lot of rescuers do fall into despondency, and I actually come at it from a totally different angle. I look at it this way. 150 years ago, there wasn't even a law in this country protecting an animal. It's 150 years later, 20 million Americans helping out dogs. Doesn't count. Like, I mean, the American rescue movement goes, you know, from eagles through crayfish at this point. I mean, it's huge. It's sweeping. It's all animals. It's $2.5 billion a year. You've got laws now in Europe that protect, for example, in Spain, you have great apes off, have the same rights as all humans. In Switzerland, there's a law that...
The same rights?
Yeah.
What they vote?
Great apes. They don't have legal... They don't have voting rights, but they are afforded the exact same rights in terms of you can't torture them, you can't injure them, you can't...
Right.
They're protected in that way with the same way humans are. Switzerland, there's a law in the book, and God knows what this means, but it protects the dignity of all organisms. Who the hell knows what that means, right?
You know, maybe. I draw the line at cockroaches, I'm sorry.
But what it shows me is that there's a sweeping change, you know, and I think whatever you want to say about history being cyclical, we as a species tend to move towards freedom. People are freer today across the board than they ever have been before, and obviously we have a very long way to go, but I think animals are what's next. And I think more and more people are kind of coming to those conclusions, and we're moving that direction, and I'm thrilled by what's going on. So people might want to look at it as pushing the rock uphill. I'm looking at it as, well, this is a giant collaborative community that's really working towards some neat goals, and that's fun. And to me, that's kind of the response. The other side of it is something that we spoke about briefly earlier, which is you wouldn't know it unless you actually get to live with a pack of dogs. But, you know, on one side, you look at all the suffering and how hard it is and blah, blah, blah. The other side is I get to live with a pack of dogs, and I get to live in a slightly alternative universe than most people get to live in, and it's super neat and super fulfilling and super interesting, and I keep learning, and it really does actually add a great deal to my life. I think when people look at it, they go, oh, my God, you live with 20 dogs. How that's got to, you know, it's going to interrupt everything you do. Well, yeah, sure it is. But it's also going to open up a whole ton of doors that nobody else gets to walk through unless you live with a pack of dogs. And those doors are really interesting.
One of the things that you talk about that's interesting is going from having a pet to having a pack. I went through the same thing. I had my little dog, Honey, and suddenly I had two dogs and three dogs and occasionally four. And it's a different dynamic. But one of the things you realize is that while they certainly are domesticated and they behave differently than the wolves from whom they are descended, on some level, you're living with these little wild animals whom you don't know. You're sharing a house with them. You have agreements with them. You have friendships and relationships with them, but you don't know them.
I think there's two points in your statement that are both really smart. The first is one of the things you see, and you've probably seen it a bit with just three dogs, four dogs, but you definitely see it when you have, you know, more than 20, is that, first of all, we now know, and we've known probably since the 70s, because thanks to the work of a neuroscientist named Jacques Panksepp, that animals have the exact same emotions as we do. They've got the same seven core emotions, they've got the same affective emotions, social emotions, and this gives them personalities that are kind of as rich as human personality. Most people don't notice because personality is something that reveals itself through comparison. When you have a pack of dogs, you can separate out breed-specific from behavior, from canine behavior, and you can actually say, oh, this is what is personality, and you start to realize that the line kind of between human and dog is a lot thinner than most people expect, and most of the, like, quirky, funny things you see in humans, you also see in dogs. One of the stories that I tell a lot is, we see a lot of homosexual behavior in our pack, which is not surprising. Homosexual behavior shows up in over 400 species of animals. But it gets really specific. We've got a tiny little hunchback chihuahua named Damien who is extremely picky about his clothes. Chihuahuas need sweaters in the mountains in the winter, right, to stay warm. Damien's really, really picky about his clothes. And when he finds a sweater to his liking, we are treated to the canine equivalent of a drag show. Literally. And whatever you feel about a drag show, like it, don't like it, you would think it's a human-specific behavior. It's not something you would describe to animals. But no, sure enough, it shows up. And those are the kinds of things that start to show up, and they start to make you kind of, not that you think less of humans, but you start to see that a lot of our behaviors actually, you know, are still animal behaviors. You know, we gussy them up with some language and whatnot, but there's not that big of a difference, and there's a lineage there.
I think this idea that human beings are the crown of creation and that we're fundamentally different. I mean, I grew up being taught that we're not animals at all, that we are human beings and that we're different from animals. And I remember studying evolution in high school and going home and having some conversations about this. And I said, but we all have eyes and noses and lungs and these are the conversations. I mean, but this is, you know, how long ago was that? Not very long ago. I think in many circles we've moved on since then. But what's happening, I think, in science, and that your book shows in lots of beautiful and different ways, is that all the ways in which we thought we were fundamentally different from other species, those lines are continually being blurred by science, by research.
You know, it's funny about that. There's a general kind of rule in science. Scientists know that, as a general rule, science is directionally accurate, but it's not always factually accurate, or it's factually accurate within a given set of what would be called boundary conditions or constraints. For whatever reason, we had this idea that humans and animals are different, and that, you know, these categories are set in stone, but there's a long list, as you just pointed out: laughter, consciousness, emotion, homosexual behavior, empathetic behavior, altruistic behavior, spiritual experience. It goes fashion. It goes on and on and on.
Tools.
Tool use. These were all supposed to be human-only categories. It's gotten to the point that one of the world's leading experts on the differences between humans and animals is a guy named Richard Granger. He's at Dartmouth. He runs the Brain Engineering Lab. He spent a couple of decades trying to find what are the differences in the brain between humans and animals. And at this point, he's found maybe 10, and they're all tiny, 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 tiny microscopic differences that actually can't account for behavior or anything we might put in the category of human specialness. So on one hand, we don't actually know why humans are special, but every time we try to put a point to something and say, this is the reason, within a couple of years, that reason goes by the wayside. So, it's an ongoing and very, very interesting puzzle. But, you know, we are definitely not as special as we once were.
The one thing we do seem to do, and we talked with this about this with Jane Goodall once, is long-term planning.
It is true, but that is that, and I agree with her. I mean, I agree that we don't see it, but we also have no idea what would an animal long-term plan for. And I mean, on a certain level, migration, which we see every year in animals, is a long-term plan. I'm going to fly south for 3 months to get someplace so I can, you know, procreate for a species that only lives, you know, a fixed amount of time, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever. Migration is a long-term plan. So, we write it off. We call it instinct, right? Oh, this isn't a long-term planning. It's instinct. But is it really? Are we sure? How do we know?
Well, and how much of what we do that we think is rational thought is in fact instinct?
That is another question as well. It's a good one.
Another thing that we take as our purview is culture, but one of the things that I've noticed, partially by having my own little dog pack and partially by seeing how differently dogs behave in different countries, is animals have their own cultures and their real cultural differences.
I think that's true. One of the things I talk about in the book is kind of very early on, we had a very persnickety, kind of mean-spirited bull terrier named Otis. And we had a miniature chihuahua named Gidget. And one day, I was on the couch. I was actually buried under dogs because it was thunderstorming out, and the dogs are all scared of thunder, and my wife was in town. And Gidget is also terrified of thunder, and Otis was kind of sleeping by my feet. And I couldn't move because, you know, I was weighed under by dogs at this point, but it started thundering, and Gidget made a mad dash for Otis. And normally, if, you know, a dog even gets into Otis's line of sight, he'll attack. And Otis was sleeping at the time, so Gidget managed to, like, run up on his back and try to dive under his arm for protection from the thunder. And Otis's immediate reaction was he looked like, you know, Goofy when he gets hit by the 2x4, like his eyebrows shot up to the ceiling. But in the next moment, I saw what I would call deductive logic in a dog. Otis kind of realized that if Gidget's on his back, well, she has to be crazy. And if she was, she's actually a brain-damaged dog. And if she was crazy, then maybe the normal rules don't apply. And Otis snorted once and went back to sleep, leaving Gidget on her back. Now, that's kind of amazing, empathetic, whatsoever. But within a week, Gidget was allowed to run up and sleep on any of the dogs in our pack. That it transmitted through the pack. Now, Otis died about 4 or 5 months after this story, and it's many, many generations of dogs who have moved through our sanctuary since then, and Gidget still gets a pass with all the dogs. So we saw cultural transmission spread through the pack, and now we have it through multiple generations of non-related animals. So that's, I mean, that's an actual example of culture. And I don't think, by the way, I don't think there's anything special going on with our dogs. I think the key point is most of the research we have on dogs is comes from one of two places. It comes from either studies run in labs, which are totally unnatural conditions, or from surveys of pet owners. Unfortunately, dogs evolved to live, large packs of dogs, small groups of humans. There are 78 million dogs in America owned by roughly 70 million families. Most people have one dog. So they're not going to see this kind of behavior. They're not creating conditions where you could even observe this kind of behavior. I don't think there's anything special going on with us seeing cultural transmission in our dogs. I just think we happen to live with a large pack of dogs, so the situation can exist.
We're talking to Stephen Cutler. His book is called A Small Furry Prayer, Dog Rescue and the Meaning of Life. There was a section in your book that I found fascinating that I thought might make a good reading right now about a terrier named Chow.
Chow was a crazy, crazy dog. She had basically everything you could possibly imagine wrong with her, including severe anger issues. She showed up. She was one of the fattest dogs I've ever seen. I couldn't actually believe how fat she was. She bit everything, anybody who came close.
Dogs and humans.
She was blind. She was mostly deaf. She was food obsessed. Her heart was failing. Most of her other organs were not far behind. She had been abused at a vet. Everything was wrong with this dog.
I have to say, when I was reading that section of the book, I thought, how can they have taken her in? I mean, that's where the dog rescue thing gets really fascinating. You took this dog in. You were ready to love this dog.
Well, if you only got a couple of dogs, you want your dogs cute and cuddly, and you want them as some, there's a part of us that, just like when you go to the store to buy a jacket, you want a jacket that kind of speaks to you, whatever. People have that relationship with dogs. They want a dog that kind of, it's a reflection of my personality or whatever it is. But when you are taking in dozens of dogs and you can drop those requirements. My dogs are not an expression of myself at all. There's no kind of ego relationship to it. Then these hospice cases and these kind of other cases become really interesting to live with. And they're, as you'll see in the section that I'm going to read, when you actually do have a success on the flip side, you spoke earlier about how, there's a cross-species friendship in and of itself is amazing. The thing that's amazing about rescue and to me, one of the most amazing things is when you have to earn that friendship, when it's not just like I got this puppy and he loved me immediately because he was a puppy, and it becomes, wow, this dog hates human beings and takes 3 months for me to earn its trust. And when that happens, when you have to earn the friendship, you start to realize, first of all, how amazing the fact that we have this cross-species friendship in the first place. It's astounding. But, the comparison I always use is when a dog like Gidget, kind of the mini Chihuahua is just talking about, runs up on my chest and kind of dances around or whatever. That's the rough equivalent of me running up on the chest of a small dinosaur.
Right.
Or an elephant or a giraffe. That is nothing I would do pretty, I would think long and hard before I did that. And our dogs do it all the time. That's astounding. The fact that it just happens is astounding. And we don't notice it because we take them for granted in this way. But with rescue animals, you got to work for it. And so the relationship becomes something that you treasure because you actually get to see it for what it is.
And so back to this dog, Chow. This is a real example.
Go
ahead and read the passage. So you've got this blind, deaf, failing, angry dog.
The thing you need to know is I'm sitting on my back porch. All of our dogs are out there at the time, and Chow is out there. And she has one of the hardest things. This is the last background story, and this is why it happened. I'd been growing really frustrated because this was still early on in our experience, and I hadn't realized that, we have dogs I can't pet. Every dog I've ever been around, I can pet. But we've got dogs who are feral or wild or aggressive or whatever, and we can't actually touch them. Chow is one of those cases. All right. Rescue can be a very intuitive process. And by intuitive, I mean that one afternoon, possibly because some tequila was involved, my better plan was screw it. I just reached down and picked Chow up. It was like trying to cuddle a tornado, spinning, shaking, snarling, biting, barking. I kept her at arm's length with my elbows locked and fingers firm until that first wave of panic subsided. In those moments of exhausted reprieve before the next round, I sat down in a chair and locked her waist between my legs. This was perhaps not the best maneuver. I had inadvertently exposed my genitals to her claws and my eyes to her teeth. Chow was already availing herself of the first target and working her way towards the second. I was all set to hurl her across the porch when intuition struck again, and I shoved my perfectly healthy hand into her vigorously snapping maw. I guess that's why they call it intuition. Chow's mouth turned out to be small enough that with my fist wedged inside, she couldn't apply nearly as much pressure. She chomped and chomped, and after about 10 minutes, the feeding frenzy vanished, suddenly replaced by profound befuddlement. Chow had finally noticed that my other hand had been stroking her back the whole while. This may have been the first time in her life that she'd felt affection, and where was it coming from? She glanced over her right shoulder, then looked left. Pretty soon she was whipping her head back and forth like a speed freak at a tennis match. It was fear of neck snapping that finally made me let her go. Then she leaped off my lap and shot across the porch, but froze at the edge. One paw lifted, the other legs bent. Whatever that next move, Chow never made it. Instead, she waddled back over, plopped down at my feet, and began licking my toes. And in dog rescue, this is what a good day looks like.
Amazing. We're talking to Stephen Cutler. Now, that's a moment where you essentially broke through to a dog's emotional side, let it know that it was loved, and from then on, the dog's behavior was different.
It was radically. Well, that was actually her breakthrough with humans. Her breakthrough with other dogs took a while, but we actually got that as well. But and this was one of those cases where she actually had a, like, the breakthrough occurred in one moment, and she was fundamentally altered. Sometimes, you know, those it takes a stack of those moments, five or six of them. It really depends on the level of the emotional response. You can get how many neurochemicals you can get flowing through the dog, essentially, to change the behavior. Sometimes it's more than that, but the intuition is interesting. I mean, you know, nothing in my life experience would ever say the best way to handle a dog is to shove my hand into its mouth, but that's what worked in that particular case.
And speaking of neurochemistry, there's something else that you write about called helper's high, and that is when you have a really profound experience of helping an animal. It also can happen helping other human beings. And it turns out that that high that people get is much greater than even extreme athletes get from doing their sport.
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting thing. And I, in my earlier book, in West of Jesus, I had really looked long and hard at the kind of the relationship between what psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi calls a flow state, or Abraham Maslow called peak experiences, with what's quote-unquote mystical experiences. And I looked at how the neurochemistry of a flow state was almost the exact same as the neurochemistry of a mystical experience, and the same things were going on in the brain. Flow states show up very frequently during sports, as you just mentioned. They show up everywhere from, you know, Larry Bird wrote about them in his autobiography in basketball. They show up in extreme sports, skiing, rock climbing, all that kind of stuff. Turns out they show up in altruism all the time. And helper's high was a term that was coined by John Lukes, who runs Big Brother, Big Sister. And he started looking at this high back in the 90s. And what he figured out very quickly is, unlike normal flow states, which can last an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours tops, and show up pretty rarely, helper's high showed up, and I'm going to get these numbers a little wrong, but they're ballpark close, in like 80 to 85% of his study group got helper's high, and a lot of them reported it lasted for days, which is significantly longer than the average flow state. So the interesting thing about altruism is not so much that, not just that it produces flow states, which in and of itself is really interesting, but the fact that they last so long and they show up so frequently. It's really another scientific puzzle.
So you are now in Chimayo, and your dog sanctuary is called Rancho de Chihuahua. What are you actually doing now? Are you getting the rescued dogs available for adoption, doing hospice, a little bit of both?
We do four things. We do hospice care for older dogs because we believe how a dog dies matters. We do long-term rehab for dogs with severe physical and emotional problems, dogs that need 1 to 2 to 3 years worth of work before they'll be eligible for adoption, if it ever. We do some kind of general fostering work where we work with shelters both here in New Mexico and a couple shelters in Los Angeles. And then we run a program called Cuddle Buddies, where we work with people with very severe handicaps, people who cannot, either because of their handicaps or their living situations or both, actually have a dog as a companion. So we essentially lend them one, and we bring the dog to them once a week so they can actually hang out with a dog, which, if you know anything about the relationship between dogs and health, dogs really, really boost our immune system for a lot of different reasons.
They keep us from having heart disease and help us recover when we have heart attacks and those kinds of things.
Everything from heart attacks through depression. As a matter of fact, one of the craziest things about dogs is, and when we talk about humans' coevolution with dogs, this is a great example of how powerful it is. The best medicine on the market for anxiety, Prozac, Zoloft, the like, they take about a month to work and they don't work in everybody.
But you and can, they have nasty side effects.
And nasty side effects. You can pet a dog for 4 to 24 minutes and then measure cortisol levels in the bloodstream. Cortisol is a stress hormone. And petting a dog for 4 to 24 minutes will drop cortisol levels lower than the very best antidepressants on the market, and it works in everybody regardless of your body's chemistry.
Extraordinary. Now, I have to say that sleeping with dogs, which is something that a lot of people think is weird, is actually something that we have been doing for, what, tens of thousands of years, millions of years?
The actual how long humans and dogs have been co-evolving is an ongoing question. The old answer used to be 14,000 years, and that was based on what are called simultaneous burials. They found humans and dogs buried together in the same gravesite. We've since developed DNA dating techniques, and there's an argument, but the number is somewhere between 50 and 135,000 years. But to your point, if we've been evolving with dogs, co-evolving with dogs for 135,000 years, we've been with dogs for longer than we've actually been human in some cases. So it's a great, big, long period of time. And I think, you know, one of the very first things that happened, why did we co-evolve with dogs? Well, why was it so mutually beneficial? There's a lot of arguments, but one of the things is they taught us how to hunt, and they acted as our alarm systems, right? We brought them into the campsites. They lived with us. They liked our garbage, which is why they were attracted to us. They wanted our refuge. But we wanted them as security alarms. So once you kind of open up to that and start sleeping with dogs, there's a whole lot of kind of DNA code in you that says, feel safe, you have a dog around you. And once you open to that, once it's gone, if you have dogs and then don't have dogs or travel or go on vacation or whatever, sleep without your dogs, it's really like there's a part of you missing. It's like you've been sleeping with a baseball bat under the bed and suddenly it's gone and you feel naked.
I know, believe me. I mean, and the three-dog night is actually a term that's real.
It's a real term. Three dog night was so cold. You need three dogs in the bed to stay warm, which was one of the other things that we got from dogs very early on is they became our hot water bottles basically, and kept us warm at night.
Well, there's a lot more to talk about, but we're just about out of time. Stephen Cutler is the author of the new book, A Small Furry Prayer, Dog Rescue and the Meaning of Life, and he will be at Garcia Street Books this Saturday, October 30th at 2 o'clock, and we'll be talking and answering questions. It's wonderful to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Ramon Calderon. He is a Cuban musician, and joining us also is Solar Banner. She is producer of the event series, along with Ramon, Cuban Night. And we missed the first one, but we've got three more coming up this Friday and the next couple of Fridays. It's about 400 years of Cuban music. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Gracias.
So 400 years of Cuban music, that sounds suspiciously like 400 years of Santa Fe. Did you do this because of our 400th anniversary?
Yeah.
Precisely, that is the reason why we decided to do this 400-year concert to commemorate in conjunction with, not only to commemorate 400 years of Cuban music, but also in conjunction with the 400-year celebration of Santa Fe, the founding of Santa Fe. So
this coming Friday, the 29th of October, is a Cuban Afro-Cuban night. This is all, by the way, happening at the Lodge here in Santa Fe. Afro-Cuban music, are we talking about popular music? Are we talking about folkloric music?
Bueno, nosotros vamos a hablar sobre las dos partes.
That's exactly right. That's what we're doing. We're doing an Afro-Cuban mix of, first of all, how this changed from originally Spanish music and also the indigenous music that was in Cuba. But when the Afro came in as the slaves, the Afro people came in as slaves, then they began to change that music. And this is, you know, this is also how Cuban music has evolved into modern day Cuban music, where there are a lot of African influences.
Let's hear an example of some Afro-Cuban music so that people have a sense of what we're talking about.
The Afro-Cuban.
In the 1600s, when we first had our first African influences, it had a lot of resistance from the music that was already in existence in Cuba, which was the Spanish influence.
So the Spaniards were resisting the African music, the African drumming.
Correct.
Because it was slave music, it was African music, it was unfamiliar to them.
Yeah.
So in 1692, when the naval British forces came to Cuba and remained there for a period of 10 months, there was a relaxation in the rules that the Spaniards had set for the African slaves, and there was a time when the English began to manufacture instruments there. And so what they did is they let the African slaves go ahead and play the drums, which had been forbidden by the Spanish previously.
There's another interesting piece of this, which is that there are so many different kinds of Afro-Cuban and Afro-Caribbean music.
Yeah. Sí, las islas del Caribe fueron como
the islands in the Caribbean were founded by Spain, England, France, and Holland. And most of these Afro-Caribeños came to Cuba with their folkloric music. So that's why this night it's not just Afro-Cuban, but it is more a mix of all of these.
Afro-Caribbean.
Afro-Caribbean.
Afro-Caribbean or Anglo-Caribbean or French-Caribbean.
French-Caribbean, yeah. That's why when you listen to the music, you listen to it with different accents and also in different languages, and that's why also the mix in the dances.
And you're going to have some Cuban dancers at the performance.
Yeah, tenemos a Jenny, tenemos Melao.
So we have two Cuban dancers, Janie and Melao, who are both from Cuba, and they are doing a ribbon dance around a pole. And the ribbons are actually woven somehow into the pole. And these dances have never been seen here in the United States before. This will be the first time.
Is that right? Very interesting.
So a lot of this music has never been recorded before, and I remember this music from when I was in Cuba, and there was actually, you know, the music there that I could take from, but this music that I did was actually music, scat music or a cappella music that I've done for this particular thing, but for the first time we're going to present it here.
And with instruments.
In Santa Fe, and with instruments.
Let's hear an example of this, of some of this music.
Yo, Bambé!
Yo!
And that's an example of Afro-Cuban music, and we're going to be hearing some of that on Afro-Cuban Night this Friday, the 29th of October. How much do we know about Cuban music from 400 years ago, 300 years ago, and so on, before there were recordings?
Bueno, nosotros precisamente el viernes pasado comenzamos.
And that's exactly what precisely happened is, you know, this music, the actual concert began in what we did with the Tonadas from 1562, so it was a little bit actually before 400 years. But what changed in Cuban music during that time, there were these two poets who had the 10-verse system of poetry. And so there is where some of these changes happen. It's called the Espinal verse. And this is where we get the Guajira flamencas during this time period. In 1610, the capital was founded. New Mexico, which is Santa Fe, was founded, well, 2 years earlier in 1608 was the capital, which at that time was Santiago de Cuba, and which was later moved to Havana because of all these invasions from pirates and corsairs. And so it's interesting that both cities were just 2 years apart in their founding.
The capital Havana and the capital Santa Fe, very interesting.
Y en esa misma época es donde.
So it's around the same time as the two cities were founded that this new verse, 10 verse from Espinal was also introduced into the music, and that's where we get the Guajira Flamenca. And at this time too, because Havana had many ports, the people would take these Guajiras and songs back to Spain as well. So there was a lot of interaction going on there with music.
One of the things that's coming up on the 5th of November, also a Friday, is French Cuban Night. And I think people may not know that there is a real French musical influence in Cuba. We know that Haiti has a French influence, but people don't think of that in Cuba. What happened?
Yeah, en Cuba hemos tenido varias emigraciones.
So in 1791, Haiti had a revolution. And what most people don't know is that there was this huge migration, and it was the very wealthy people who were coming to Cuba, but they were also bringing in their slaves from Haiti, their black slaves from Haiti during this time. So these people who migrated also brought their artistic, the way that they lived. They brought, for
chamber
instance,
music. Musica de camera, chamber music.
Yeah, musica de camera, which is chamber music. But they also brought in their art, and they brought in a lot of the things that they had, being upper class, very upper class people. And so this is what was brought into Santiago de Cuba. And so it began to change things there for the people who were there. And this influence added more to the music that was already there.
Should we hear an example? ¿Podemos escuchar un ejemplo?
Oh, sí. Podemos escuchar a La Bella Cubana de José White.
So that was an example of Cuban music with a very French influence, and that's something that you're going to be performing on Friday night, the 5th of November. Now, we talked about Afro-Cuban Night, which is this coming Friday, French-Cuban Night, which is the 5th of November, and then on the 12th of November, Cuban-Cuban Night. What does that mean? I mean, Cuban music is so much a combination of all of these influences, African, Spanish, French.
And United States.
And United States. So what is Cuban Cuban?
Cuban Cuban is in
1898 through 1902 began the Spanish-American War. And so they also began to bring in more influences into Cuba with the music from here. And then there also was a process where the Spanish music was also going away from Cuba. And also there was like a small resistance from the people of Cuba to have the music from the United States come into Cuba.
Because of a nationalistic feel.
Yes, because of the nationalistic. And because of this independence movement, there was a little bit of rebelliousness when the music first began to come in. So then there was kind of a new movement that evolved from that, which was a little bit rebellious too, where there was trying to recapture some of the folkloric stuff and at the same time bringing in the new stuff. Yeah, we began to experience some acceptance in Cuban music in 1930 when the song El Manicero came out, The Peanut Vendor, which of course many of the jazz people picked up and began to perform. There began to be then a bigger acceptance in relationship with, for instance, the jazz bands in 1945 and also with Cubop. So everyone, I think, is familiar with when the mambo came in and the cha-cha-cha came in and salsa and casino came in. And so this is kind of what we're familiar with as Cuban music.
So Cuban music, shall we hear an example of that right now?
Bueno, sí, Changui Son y Charanga Son, que son los grupos que estamos tocando acá, música en vivo en Santa Fe.
So we're going to hear something, and the kind of music that Changui Son plays, and they're here in Santa Fe. They are playing after every single one of these Cuban night concerts. So there will be a concert of music and then a dance night with Changui Son, and this really represents what we might call Cuban music.
Llegó Ramón y su Changui Son. ¡Ja, mira qué rico!
I want to thank you, Ramón Calderón, Cuban musician, and Solar Banner, producer of the event series Cuban Night. And these are going to be happening the next... We didn't get in time to do this before the first one, but then this Friday and the next two Fridays after that, the next three Fridays at the Lodge here in Santa Fe. And for more information, you can call 992-2800. And you can also get tickets at Santa Fe Music and Piano. Their number there is 989-8998. And they are right here in the same plaza as the Santa Fe Baking Company. So thank you both so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And we will see you on Friday night.
Thank you.
Thank you, too.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.